I feel like we should set up a timer and like count down.
If you're listening to this, it's probably Tuesday or Wednesday, the 26th or the 27th of December. What statistically do people? I guess people listen mostly on the day that it goes up, don't they?
That would be Boxing Day, I do believe, internationally.
Yeah.
Probably either the day it comes out or the day after.
Yeah. Okay. You know? So it's probably the 26th or the 27th of December, but for us here in the real world. So what would we, in the real world, what would we have taken? Would we have taken the blue pill? Go back to.
Yeah. No. I want to eat the steak. What does the guy say when he's
Which
just
one
like,
is it?
I want a steak to taste. I want everything to taste like this. I want to be rich.
Yeah. But what's the, is it the red pill?
I think red pill makes you go down the rabbit hole. Blue.
Okay. And then the blue pill, you go back to your desk and anyway,
yeah,
so whatever. So whatever not the Matrix is, we're in there. Or maybe we aren't really.
Do you think we're in the Matrix? I mean, there was that whole Elon Musk thing.
A lot of physicists are making the argument that it's that this entire thing is a simulation.
Just a big 3D projection, yeah.
If it is, I would like to revert to an earlier save.
that was a video game joke.
Right. So anyway, so it is episode 296, 296.
Yeah.
Bill Wadman is in Brooklyn.
It's me.
And Jeffrey Sidoris, that's me. I'm in Silver Spring. Shooting pictures today, Bill. Shooting pictures.
You are? For what?
Yeah. The book. My book.
Oh, shooting of pictures of the
I
book.
I have.
That's meta.
I have it.
You have it. You're taking pictures of pictures that you've taken.
Sort of. Yeah. In a roundabout sort of way. But yeah, got the first shipment of many boxes of books. They will go on sale. I think they'll start shipping on the 30th because this is the thing. I was going to put them up now today.
Yeah.
Well, today, the 21st when we're recording, but
sure.
For people who are listening, you're like, anyway, so I was going to put them up immediately, but then I thought, well, they're only going to be up for 2 days and then I got to pull them down because I'm going to be gone for a week and they're not going to make Christmas anyway, even if I put them up today. So
you're just saying wait till after Christmas.
I think I'm just going to wait and then I can do kind of a full court press on promotion and getting the word out there. But I got to tell you, man, it was worth the wait.
Good.
It looks good.
I'm glad you're happy.
I was really apprehensive opening the boxes. In fact, they got here and I couldn't open the boxes.
You were unable to? Your arthritis was
it was just that.
You're so nervous.
Yeah, it was like I was thinking to myself, what if I forgot something? What if I screwed up? What if they screwed up? What if the spine width wasn't right? What if all these goofy things? And,
sure.
And Fielding came home and she's like, well, got to open the boxes.
Yeah. Well, why is there a box here that you haven't opened?
10 boxes.
Yeah.
So I was like, I just couldn't. She's like, well, honey, got to open the box. You can't just leave the living room full of boxes.
Right.
So, but man, it's really good. I am so pleased with it. I am thrilled that this project has come to an end. It's a weird feeling to hold something. I wasn't prepared for how different I would feel holding the printed copy versus like the ebook copy on my iPad because ostensibly it's the same thing.
Yeah.
The same information.
Yep.
But there is something about it.
It's different when it's a physical good.
Yeah. Yeah. So, December 30th, they will go on sale. I hope those of you who are listening and have been patiently waiting for them to be done and in, I hope you love that. I hope you love it as much as I do. I hope you're happy with it. And, I am going to thank you in advance for picking up a copy. So anyway,
excellent. I look forward to seeing it.
Hey, speaking of books.
Yep.
Did you see this?
Yeah. with the Avedon thing?
Yeah. The Avedon Foundation wants his book, his biography called Avedon, Something Personal, pulled from production because of it, apparently it is riddled with inaccuracies about the late Richard Avedon.
The problem I have with this, their argument is that it's based upon some of the stories in the book were based upon a somewhat fictitious, slightly historical, fictitious autobiography that he was writing at the time of his death. Correct? Something along lines where he was telling stories from his life, but manipulating the story a little bit to make it more fun for the book. And a copy of this was stolen by one of his former workers, and that's what they're basing this off of, and that some of the stuff isn't true. It's just what Dick was saying in the book. So you know, there's an argument to be said for what they're saying. The problem I have with this is that if I didn't already know, remember that whole thing with the Avedon Foundation and the guy who was his printer who had a copy of the American West stuff that they won't validate?
Unsigned.
Right, and they won't, it's, you know, so... There's a little bit of, it feels like Avedon Foundation is run by a bunch of jerks. Just, I know that's not necessarily true, but like from the information I have and the stories I've heard, that's the tendency I have, the knee jerk reaction I have. So I read this thing and I go, maybe these stories are true, but they just don't want them public because they're embarrassing in some way. You know what I mean? And they'll like lower the value of the work or whatever the, you know, argument is inside of the whole thing, make him look bad. So yeah, I don't know. Plus, either way, like, what is it to that? Like, it's not, what, they could say it's slander, I guess. You know what I mean? Like, what legal argument
maybe
do they
have? Maybe it's painting a picture of their client that is inaccurate. Down the bottom of this article, a spokesperson at Penguin Random House responded and said, Avedon himself, in his last will, appointed Norma Stevens as founding director of his foundation, thereby entrusting his legacy to her. This book is... an important and meaningful account by the person who was in a privileged position to observe and know Richard Avedon as well as anybody else and to reflect on him. Furthermore, the book is not a traditional biography. As the flap copy says, the book is, quote, equal parts memoir, biography, and oral history, end quote. It consists in large measure of impressions, those of his close friend and business partner, Norma Stevens, as well as those of over 100 other people who knew him well and contributed their own memories and impressions. The story she tells recounts tales he told her in almost 30 years she worked alongside him.
It's a long, big book, too.
Yeah.
720 pages.
Yeah, that's big.
Available for $25 on Amazon. I'll put a link in the show notes. Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I'd be interested in at least getting or flipping through a book. I mean, sometimes these books are just so long and drawn out, I don't have patience for 800 pages of it.
Yeah.
But
I wonder if there's a middle ground. Could they change the book, you mean? Well, or a title or putting a disclaimer. I mean, nowhere on the cover does it imply that it's an official memoir or an official biography.
Well, therein lies my problem with the whole thing is that, okay, who cares if you think that it's a lie? That's not how it works. You know, that's not how books work. There's plenty of unauthorized biographies of all kinds of people that people have problems with, you know? So like, why is this any different? You know?
Yeah.
I think probably half of these stories are more true than the foundation wants to admit. And maybe they're like a little embarrassing. I wouldn't be surprised if that was the reality.
Hmm.
I don't know.
Hmm.
That's just my, you know,
They want Avedon to be remembered and represented in a certain way, maybe?
Absolutely.
Is that kind of what you're, okay.
I mean, both for, you know, just respecting him as an artist, but probably also for the value of the work that's out there. I mean, that is an element. They have a lot of it, I'm sure. You know, so they have a vested interest to maintain him as something other than perhaps what he was, you know, which is with a lot of these people who make a lot of work. A lot of them have all kinds of crazy stuff they've done in their life or whatever it is. And you kind of, people end up whitewashing their biographies to make them look more presentable, you know?
Right.
But that's time of memoriam kind of stuff. yeah, I like this article. Well, okay. So apparently Apple in an attempt to keep batteries from dying too quickly in older phones has been sort of reordering instructions that go through the CPU of older phones in a way that technically slows down newer pieces of OS software. So something along that line, right? So
yeah, effectively, yeah, they're throttling performance of 6, 6S, 7.
The argument being that these phones, you know, that they're older phones, so inherently if you push the CPU too hard, the battery will get pulled too hard, and right. the phones will, you know, dump out at the bottom, like will shut down or do weird things, and that they don't want that terrible thing to happen, so therefore they're saving you by slowing down your phone.
you want to save me? Give me a replaceable battery.
Yeah. There are certainly people who would that's the nice way of saying it. The less nice way of saying it is that they're slowing down old phones that you buy a new phone.
Right.
I mean, that's the fear. Do you think there's any of that in there?
Yes. Yes. Yeah. I mean, Apple was one of, and still is, a company for whom planned obsolescence, if not on a roadmap somewhere, it's certainly part of the culture of the way they design their products. Yeah.
Interestingly, in this article, there's a
seems to be anyway.
Yeah, there's a tweet by a guy named Sirumu. Anyway, he says he's got pictures there. He's got one of them shows his CPU frequency at 600 megahertz. The other one at 1400 megahertz, so over twice as fast. Right.
Mm-hmm.
He says the one on the left shows his iPhone CPU underclocked, running at 600. After an iPhone battery replacement, CPU speed resumes to factory setting of 1400. So basically, if your battery is old, they're going to slow down your CPU. Is there any reason to actually do you trust them at all? Do you say like, well, you know what? Maybe that is a way to mitigate old batteries or something.
I don't know. I mean, in light of how many batteries have been replaced in 6s and 6s's,
yeah.
I mean, I had mine replaced, and the store in that I went to in Bethesda said that, you know, they had thousands of them in that store.
Right.
They had pallets of batteries being replaced and
But this guy's tweet shows that when you do replace the battery, it does go back up to full speed.
Yeah, right. if you qualify, that was the other thing. It wasn't just a blanket thing. You had to go to Apple and you had to make two appointments. The first appointment determined whether you were able to, and then they would order the battery for you, and then you'd have to come back and have it put in. It's like, well,
you can pay to get the battery replaced, can't you? Or is that not an option?
I'm not sure. I would imagine it is.
At one point, it was. I don't know what the current thing is. If anybody has any information on this, let us know.
If you are looking for a new phone, Marques Brownlee, MKBHD, just put up his roundup of the best phones of 2017, rounded them out. Let's see, MKBHD.
I'll find it. Keep talking.
Yeah, did them based on different criteria. Large phone, small phone, best camera.
Smartphone Awards 2017.
Yeah, Smartphone Awards 2017. And look at this first scene. Look at all the phones he's got. Those are all phones that came out in 2017.
Oh, God, there's just so many.
Yeah. Oddly enough, his vote for best camera. Google Pixel 2.
I'm not surprised.
Yeah. By a long shot, he said. So anyway, put that in there too. Maybe people will be interested in that.
Yeah, look at all these phones. Galaxy Note 8, Razer, iPhone 8, Google Pixel 2, Samsung Galaxy 8, iPhone 10, OnePlus 5T, Moto 5G, Huawei Honor, Central Phone, HTC U. Man, there's a lot of phones. The one problem, and this is the standard thing with Apple, is that like if you want an iPhone or you want to use iOS, you just got to buy whatever the Apple phone is right now, you know. You don't really have much option, you know, unless you want to go Android. Yeah.
Just for our own sort of edification. See that little link there, Video Gear I Use, right down there at the bottom.
Okay, Video Gear.
You see that?
Use. Yep.
Go ahead and click on that.
Oh, it's so unnecessary. Yeah, he uses a Red Weapon, which is better than the cameras they use to make movies.
Yeah,
it's an Canon 8K lenses,
an 8K video camera.
Does he ever explain why he uses all this crazy gear? I mean, his videos look good, but they would look good with 1/10 the camera gear.
They would look for the way most people view them, e.g. on their phones or tablets.
Yeah.
You could shoot him on a GX7 or a, you know.
Does he? I wonder if Red gave him that camera and that's why he uses it.
I don't know.
I wouldn't be surprised if it was.
I mean, good on him, you know. Well done.
Yeah,
but it
sure.
just seems like but a lot of gear for.
Somewhat wholly unnecessary for what he's doing.
Yeah.
Anyway. That's, you know, everyone wants to make fancy videos. There's a lot of people doing kind of what he does, right?
Yes, but he is very good at it. I will give him that.
Yeah,
overkill or not on the production end, there is something trustworthy about him. There's something honest. He seems to have a lot of integrity. Now, maybe that'll all go to shit and some scandal will break. But for now, I think he's a good guy.
See, I
knowledgeable.
Think he seems like a good guy. I think he's fairly knowledgeable. I think he presents very well. I don't think that his stuff is particularly in depth. Like when I read reviews, I like, you know, going into detailed stuff. Like I like DP review level reviews of cameras, not CNET level reviews of
sure,
cameras.
Sure. Or know? Tom's Hardware Guide.
Exactly. Right. I want the Anon Tech
version.
Sure. So his things are a little bit superficial when it comes to reviews of stuff, which is fine. That's his audience. So that's the only reason I don't really watch a lot of his stuff.
Right.
you want to jump into these? We got a bunch of questions.
Yeah, sure. Sure.
Yeah, you want to start? You want me to start? You want
big
to
Q&A. I don't know. Go ahead.
Andrew Bull, number one.
What's up, Andrew?
I used to work in print, now work online, and thought I had a handle on color spaces. I recently had some shots printed as promotional posters, and the colors were way off. I've been reading up and viewing on Lynda about this, and it turns out I had my Photoshop settings wrong. Can't believe I got this wrong. Print stuff. That's such a... See, let me finish this. I think I'm out of trouble now, but for everyone's benefit, Bill or Jeffrey, because you've done a lot more of this recently, can you take us through your color space setup? What space do you shoot in? What's your default Photoshop space? How do you output images for different uses, i.e. print, offset, lab, home, or the web? Do you edit Photoshop in 16-bit? Do you use the same rendering intent or vary it from shot to shot? Ooh, lots of stuff in there.
Yeah.
You know, you went through a whole lot of stuff with the book when it came to color. Can we do like a quick round?
Yeah, I mean,
that?
Well, first of all, they wanted everything in RGB, and that runs kind of contrary to what you normally think of in a commercial print space, which is CMYK.
Right.
And in fact, you know, I talked to you, I talked to Rotz, I talked to, you know, three or four other people and said, is this normal? And each of them who have been, you know, each of some of my friends who've been printing photo books were like, yeah, that's kind of strange. My printer wants everything CMYK. And the reason that they wanted everything in RGB is so that they can rip to CMYK to their specific hardware on their end.
Okay.
And it worked fine for the photos. The photos in the book looked superb from day one. What didn't look good, or what did go through some shifting, were the interface elements, you know, solid block colors, mastheads, things like that, that I had not done in CMYK. They were instead RGB, and there was a shift in color, but they didn't shift normally. And correct me if I'm wrong on this, Bill, but normally the expected outcome is if you convert from RGB to CMYK, there's a dulling of the color. There's a dulling down of the color because CMYK is a smaller color space.
Smaller gamut. So things that are really saturated, the inks just can't produce it. So it just pulls it back to the closest
pulls
one it
back.
Can.
Well, my colors went the opposite direction. They became more vibrant. The sort of vintagey, retro-inspired color that I had used throughout suddenly looked like primary colors from a box of Crayolas, right?
Right, okay.
And I couldn't figure it out. So did a proof, did another proof, and finally went, tell you what, here's what I'm going to do. Would you guys print a color chart for me? And they were kind enough. They said, yeah, sure, send one along. So I took all of the RGB colors, put those on the color chart. I converted those to CMYK, straight CMYK conversion, included those. And then I gave myself three variations of each color, slightly more sort of muted and less saturate than the two, you know,
the original colors and sent that off to them, and they sent it back. And what I ended up doing was basically tailoring my color to their print output.
Which one came closest to the color I was looking for? I'll just change all mine to that. That kind of thing?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. So while it may not have looked right on screen, the print version that I got back was dead on. That was exactly what I wanted.
Which is interesting, because it should theoretically, in some ideal universe, you should be able to have it come out from the screen to the printer and have it look pretty damn close.
And again, the photographs did. The photographs looked terrific.
Right. Which is weird that the spot colors that you gave them originally in RGB weren't the same, didn't do the same, like the same conversion didn't work for them.
Yeah. Yeah. So, you know, that was my experience with that. But in terms of photos, I typically shoot in Adobe RGB if I'm not shooting RAW. You know, I usually use RAW plus JPEG, but the color space in the camera is set to Adobe RGB.
Yep.
I have everything set at 16-bit Adobe RGB. If I output for the web, I output at sRGB.
I use the stock, because most of the time I am sending, it's always RGB. I never convert to CMYK, certainly not for any of my clients, right? They want my photos the way they are. Mm-hmm. Having them look the way I expect them to look in print, I mean, there's the whole question of brightness and calibration of my monitor, which I do use i1 Pro. Is that what the thing is called? Yeah. With the Dell monitor I have, there are internal lookup tables. So there's a Dell software that's based off the i1 calibrator that is like designed for the Dell, so that when it does a calibration, it sticks the profiles essentially in the monitor as opposed to in the computer, so that I could plug this computer into any, or the monitor into any computer theoretically, and it would be pretty dead on. I do it at 120 candelas per meter, if anybody's interested in that kind of stuff. I do shoot Adobe.
Which, for those of you who have your monitors set to factory brightness,
is really, yes, is pretty low. Like I can't even tell you actually where my brightness is, because I can't, when you do the calibration, it actually shuts off the brightness contrast control on the monitor.
Right.
It's like just locks it down, so you can't even get in there.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's
typical factory brightness is retina burning.
Yeah,
by
yeah.
comparison.
And for people who print at home or send their stuff out and it comes back and they're just like, it was way too dark. It's because your monitor is too bright. So when you're working on pictures, you think that it's really bright. So if you want it to be like mid-tones, you'll pull it way down. But the reality of it is that the file is actually much darker than that. It's just that your monitor's brightening it up. So when you send it off to the printer, it comes out dark because the file actually is dark. You're just looking at it pumped up a bunch, you know? So there's that. Color spaces, I'm always just in I use Adobe RGB. For a while I was using the Pro RGB or whatever it is, like the Pro Photo RGB which is
it's
really
a big color space.
That is a huge color space, which is more than I need. I'm not shooting landscape stuff where, you know, the color is that crazy. And nothing I'm printing to, especially my clients, are ever going to print that big. I do edit in Adobe RGB. When I export for clients and stuff, I usually move it to sRGB just because it's safer. And most of my stuff does not shift all that much because of it. I used to edit in 16-bit TIFFs or PSDs, but usually TIFFs, because that was like the standard in Lightroom used to export TIFFs default for a while, or it still does, as opposed to PSDs. And there are advantages of whether or not you want to compress or something, because it saves faster, and I won't get into that. But I used to use 16-bit and did for a long, long time, because I was pulling up shadows a lot. And with the Canon, you noticed it more when you pulled the shadows up between the 16 and 8-bit, because there wasn't as much information there. But I've been spending some time with a bunch of retoucher friends of mine having dinner here or there or whatever. And I was talking to one guy a few months ago, and he's just like, I never edited in 16-bit. Like, no, he's just like, maybe I'll open up a RAW file in 16-bit, make my drastic change that I think is going to require 16-bit, flatten it down, switch it to 8-bit, and start working from there. Like basically keeping twice the data at that point is overkill, according to, like, in his opinion.
Yeah. I think it depends on what you're shooting. You know, if you're shooting lots of skies and gradients, You'll see some banding occasionally.
Yeah. And that's the thing. But I mean, like in a JPEG, it's going to look pretty good. And so lately, actually, I've been editing in 8-bit, and you know, no one said suddenly, you know, your picture's color is not as detailed or whatever it is. So, and it saves, you know, half the space. So on really serious stuff that I really care about, I'll still do 16-bit, but most of the time it's just faster to use 8-bit. Right. And rendering intent, when I print, like I don't print at home anymore. Because my printer died again, which is a larger question. What is it? Absolute color metric, relative color metric? I don't know which Lightroom defaults to.
Relative.
Okay, so that's what I use.
I don't know if it's got black point is that black point compensation? Is that
yeah? But here's the thing, Andrew, is that if you sent your pictures to a commercial printing place, like promotional posters, and the colors are way off. Something either your monitor isn't calibrated right or something, because if you sent those off as RGB and they stuck them through their rip and went to CMYK, like that's their job. And especially with images, it shouldn't be that far off, you know, especially right. Not in today's world.
Right.
My guess is it's either something's wrong with the printer. You sent them CMYK when they're asking for RGB, or your monitor calibration is off, or I feel like there's some sort of user error somewhere in that chain. Because it shouldn't be that far off. Regardless of all the stuff we just said, if you shot a picture in your camera sRGB and sent it to some print place, it should come out pretty damn good, you know? In fact, right after we finish the show, I got to go to Adorama and pick up a bunch of prints for people who bought prints, and I have no fear that they're going to look terrible. Like, they're going to look good, you know, because they keep looking good from them, and I'm not doing anything special. I just send them RGBs online. RGB JPEGs online. You think that covers that one?
Andrew, good? All right. he's nodding his head right now.
Yes, it's great, guys.
Danny Levy, which museum is your favorite when looking for inspiration? I love going to museums, and it's often surprising to see which works of art get me inspired in my photography. Are the old masters an influence on your work? Does abstract or conceptual art ever inspire you to make certain pictures? And 3, what kinds of art would you recommend for photographers to explore?
You have any thoughts?
Favorite museum for inspiration. I'm a big fan of the Getty in California.
Okay.
I love that museum.
The big one, not the villa.
Well, both actually. The villa, although the villa is now the restoration center, it was the museum at one time. But yeah, the Getty.
Wait, hold on a second. The villa's not open to like as a museum anymore.
You can still go there, but it's their main restoration center.
Oh, okay. When did that change?
Not long after the Getty Center opened up.
Oh, interesting. Okay.
Yeah, for those of you who don't know, there are two Gettys. There's the Getty Center, which is the giant complex designed by Richard Mayer. Off the 405 freeway, but the older Getty, which is referred to as the Getty Villa, is on a cliff overlooking the Pacific Ocean in Malibu, and it's a beautiful space. It's like a recreation of a first century Roman villa.
Yeah, you feel
absolutely
like you're in Italy.
Beautiful. Yeah, beautiful, beautiful, beautiful.
That's what oil money gets you, people.
Yeah, right. So the Getty, probably my favorite museum. Are the old masters? Not really for me.
Yeah.
Not really.
Definitely are for me.
Yeah, for you, more so.
Yep.
Abstract or conceptual art, yes, probably more for me than for you.
Yep. Yeah. I'll go see a lot of that stuff, but it doesn't – I don't look at it and go, oh, I want to make art like that, you know,
yeah.
Everyone's got their thing that they're sucked into or that gets them off, that makes them feel like, you know, inspires them. For me, it definitely is a lot of old master stuff, although – sometimes I'll look at newer painting stuff. And when I say newer, I mean early 20th century, mid 20th century. And I'll think about lately, I've been thinking about this a lot and I don't quite know how I'm going to do it, but like there's sort of an abstraction that I'd like to try to make happen in a flat photograph. And mm-hmm. I don't know if it's a composite, like a weird sort of cutout composite kind of thing or what, but there's a feel that certain things have this like flatness that I'd like to try to make happen. But yeah, it's something I've been thinking about.
Friend of the show, Sean Tucker, posted another video recently. He did a mentor project where he went to South Africa and photographed these three men who were big influences in his adolescent life. And the photos are terrific. Yes, fine, great. But his approach to it was what I really liked about it. And he created this mood board of portraits that he put up on his wall next to his computer. And he had kind of a legend of colored dots. There were four colored dots. Like one color was I like the lighting. The other color was I like the pose. The other color was I like the, you know, whatever it is. And he would put these dots on some of his favorites and did this for months prior to this shoot, just to let the feel of what he was after kind of sink in.
Yep.
And let the inspiration of the types of portraits that he wanted to take sink in. And I thought that was kind of a neat thing that you don't really hear about mood boards a lot anymore. But they are kind of an interesting idea when you've got a definite target that you'd like to hit, a definite visual target, whether that's a look and feel or a type of lighting. So it was interesting.
The idea of doing that in a very sort of formal way, which I think is something that is the kind of way that's the way your brain tends to work, or at least that's the way you like that idea.
Yeah, I do mood boards for a lot of things.
You know, and I try to do that, and in general, I'm disappointed with how it comes out, and I'm you know, so
I think it depends on the end product.
Yeah,
you know, for the book, I collected a lot of, you know, old camera manuals, old advertising, old one sheets. You know, that kind of hit the mark of where I wanted to go visually. So I kept coming back to that when I got stuck. You know?
Right. I think, yeah, that's the place when you get, and especially with a bigger project like that, where there is an iterative process to it all, as opposed to, you know, doing a single photograph or a single shoot or something. Yeah,
sure.
But there are plenty of times I have a folder in my Dropbox that is, God, how many is it now? It's not that big. And honestly, if you go look at it, it's a lot of pictures of, let's see, inspiration. I have an inspiration folder with 563 JPEGs in it. And it's just random stuff that I see on the net that I'm like, oh, that's a really great picture of that person or that, you know, you know, it's mostly portraits, or it'll be there was that picture that Abe Morello did of a cello. I think we talked about it one time things like that, that I look at and I go, oh man, that's a really interesting way to shoot a cello, or that lighting is really interesting, or the way that woman is posed, or, you know, that kind of thing, or retouching or what have you. And when I'm shooting somebody it's more of a fashion-y sort of inspired shoot, or something that is like, oh, you know, I want to try something with somebody who is willing to play around a little bit. There's a lot of people who aren't willing to play around when you're taking portraits. And then there are people who are actresses and that kind of stuff, and they'll do whatever the hell you want, you know? So I'll go in here sometimes and I'll just flip through and I'll be like, oh, that would be interesting. Let me try a sort of a twist on this old picture from the 60s. You know what I mean? And so that totally happens. But that's just a matter of me like keeping this stuff here. And of course, you know, anybody who's seen my work knows that I'll go look at the old mastery kind of people, and I like that look.
What do you recommend? This last part, what kinds of art would you recommend for photographers to explore?
I guess it depends what kind of photographs you want to make, you know?
Yeah, that's a hard one.
Although, you know, like we've said before, I mean, there's not a whole lot of photography or paintings or anything else at, say, MoMA of just to name a place. I go to MoMA all the time because we're members, and I go in and I like to see a lot of stuff. Not much of it directly relates to the kind of pictures that I take, you know, because they're much more abstract, most of it, but it doesn't mean that it doesn't inspire me in some like deeper level, you know, on some sort of basic, like, oh wow, I want to do something that has that kind of feel or something, you know. That sort of, it's, you know, I say color, but I don't mean color. I mean, you know, the way it makes me feel.
Right.
I mean, it also depends where you are. Like, you know, you and I, you were in LA, now you're in DC, I'm in New York, I went to school in Boston. Like, we've been in the probably the four places with the greatest museums in America, you know, in those places.
Sure.
So, you know, it's, I will also say that that crazy Google site that we found, that Google art thing.
Right.
If you don't want to go anywhere, like,
that's or if you can't go anywhere.
Yeah. That is a amazing place.
Yeah, maybe
to go.
Maybe add a link. We can find a link.
The Google art project. I'll go find the Google arts and culture. I'll add it right now. In fact, interestingly enough, they have a whole section of MoMA and they have a whole section of the J. Paul Getty Museum. Yeah. So right there, you don't even have to go anywhere.
There you go. Save yourself the traffic of the 405. Yeah.
Always or the a fires. Good
thing. Yeah. Yeah. Right.
John Burridge, the collective, often talk about the advantage. No, it's just you, me, and Jeffrey, John. That's the only people talking about.
It's just the three of us.
We talk about the advantages gained with increasing sensor size, like greater depth of field, medium format sensors having a certain look, blah, blah, blah. My question is how come we never go in the reverse direction? Do we ever talk about what we lose when downsizing our sensors to Olympus or Fuji caliber? Fuji may have laudable in-camera JPEGs, but is there a look? It's not like I can't get bokeh out of my Fuji X-T1 with a long enough lens. And yet we always seem to talk about the benefits of larger sensors while not mentioning any alleged sacrifices in image quality or feel when going in the other direction, or is it just me? I'd like to add to this question. This is me, Bill. We also don't talk about the advantages of smaller sensors because there are some advantages of smaller sensors. So,
never having shot full frame digital, I've always used a cropped sensor. I don't see a disadvantage for what I do. I don't. Nope. I see the crop sensor, in fact, as an advantage, and a lot of people do. As you just mentioned, a lot of landscape shooters, a lot of wildlife shooters, shoot on crop for that extra 50% reach that that lens gives them. Instead of that, now a 300 millimeter, now you're out at 450.
Yeah. And for all the advantages of short depth of field of larger sensors, and that is true of full frame 35 in the sense that you could have really fast 1.4, 1.8, even 1.2 in the case of some of the Canon stuff, lenses that gives you this incredibly short depth of field. In medium format, like my camera, the fastest lenses are 2.8, which is the equivalent of like a 1.4 full frame 35. But there are plenty of times when, and I'm not going to give this up, but it is a trade-off of my camera where I want more depth of field in the case of a group portrait, or, where it's like, wow, I got this guy and this guy or this woman and this guy, and she's got to be 6 inches in front of him for whatever reason, and I don't have strobes and I can't stop down to F16 to make sure I get them both in focus. Like where on a smaller camera, maybe F8 would be good enough, So there are times when getting a deep depth of field is actually an advantage. And a lot of people, that's why, a lot of the people who shoot with phones, it's like, the deep depth of field that you get on phones, they keep making the lenses faster on phones. And people are like, oh, now we can get this bokeh and we can make fake bokeh and we can do all this. It's like, man, sometimes deep depth of field is actually a really cool effect, right? Like that's everything's
a trade-off. And to the point about, full frame having shallower depth of field. I mean, yes, in certain situations that is true, but it really depends on the lens choice. And there are a lot of crop sensor lenses now, even in Micro Four Thirds, that are in the 1.4, 1.2 range, where you are you are able to get shallow depth of field on a smaller sensor.
There is, since we're deep into this topic, there is a difference in the way that the look that he's talking about with different sensor sizes has to do with the not just the overall absolute objective depth of what's in focus and what's not, but the way that it falls off forward and back from that plane of focus.
Sure.
I mean, and this isn't like this is better. I'm just saying this is just a fact, right? That that is the difference that people talk about when they talk about a certain look of a sensor size has to do with how the fall off happens. It's like, and that's not a quantitative thing about the bokeh or bokeh. It's optical physics, right?
To his other point, I think that smaller sensor cameras, some of them do have a definitive look. We've talked about the look of Fuji JPEGs. Famously, the Ricoh GR2 has a look for its black and white that many people, that's why they shoot that camera, is for that crunchy, crispy black and white that it produces.
And we've also talked about the Fuji 16 megapixel versus 24 megapixel sensor. And some people say it doesn't have the same magic that the 16 megapixel did. I'm not saying that it does or does not. I haven't used both of them enough. So there are sacrifices, I guess, but you know, there's plenty of people who's Scott Bourne, right?
Mm-hmm.
Who famously or unfamously, you know, switched to Olympus and Luminar, and he does his pictures of birds or whatever in flight, and you know, the autofocus is great and the image quality is great because he's shooting in pretty bright light most of the time. You know, there might be trade-offs, and
but he's enjoying five stop stabilization and two times crop and not killing his back and hips and arms and legs at the same time, you know.
So yes, there are trade-offs, but I don't think that they are. I mean, you know, I like my camera as much for the size of the sensor. I actually just like the ratio of the sensor as much as I like the size of the sensor. You know, I like not having to crop as much off when I want to use it at a more square kind of thing and not wasting all those pixels. That's like one of the reasons why I like my camera. So it's not always just sensor size. It's also there's other things involved, you know.
Well, we'll see how you feel when the shutter fails.
Yeah. it's going to be a pain in the ass.
All right, John, you good? You good, John? remember, kids, smash that like button. sent a Twitter message to us about that and highlighted it. It was pretty funny. Ryan Davies. Damn it, Ryan. This guy again. I'm kidding. Ryan, how are you? I'd like to start creating a physical archive of personal photos. Good idea, Ryan. So that the sum of my photography is more than a hard drive full of raw files plus sidecar files containing the edits. I like where you're going with this, man.
He just needs a better loop. He could just stare at the hard drive. Right. It's really close up. He can see all those pictures.
I want to have physical photographs to browse through in 20, 30, 40 plus years. Love it, man. Potential ideas so far include printing 8x12s and throwing them in an annual archival box, making a blurb book at the end of each year, easy via Lightroom, or printing 5x7s and slotting them into traditional photo albums like my parents did. Why not mix it up, man? Why not do a little of all three of those things? They're all terrific choices. I mean, look, Bill, you're probably in this same boat. I've got photos from you know, my childhood. Yeah, the colors have shifted a little bit, but...
A little bit? They had color when you were a child?
They're tintypes, so they don't really shift a lot. Some of the glass plates have cracked, but, what do you think, man? I love the idea of a print archive. It's one of the things that I've silently sort of committed myself to for the next year is printing more.
Yeah, I do as well. I'm trying to figure out, it's an interesting thing. I'm trying to figure out a better way to do this in a way that, like, I just printed out a bunch of stuff with Adorama, the stuff I have to go pick up later. And, you know, I could theoretically get an 8x10 or an 11x14 printed of each of the ones I shot in the last year, but that would cost me, you know, $1,200 or whatever it is to get done. So I'm not going to do all of them. So it's sort of trying to choose which ones are worthy of going in some sort of thing that is printed out that I have physical copies of. I like the idea of the annual is it biannual or semi-annual? Which one's twice a year?
Biannual, I think.
Okay. Whatever.
Yeah. Biannual would be every other year. Semi-annual would be twice a year.
Okay. I'm saying twice a year. Making every 6 months, making a blurb book. Because you know what? The blurb books, especially if you do, there's the higher end paper. I don't know. I forget what they call it. Like signature? No. There's the regular paper, and then there's like a higher end, like luster paper, I think it is. Mm-hmm. Which
is that the Fuji Crystal Archive?
No, it's not. It's like not that? Like, well, that's the way Adorama does their books on actual Fuji Crystal book stuff. But this is just sort of, you know, CMYK printing. But the paper is like a coated sort of luster paper, and it's thick and it feels really good. And I've had blurb books, like portfolios printed out, that I think are arguably some of the better prints of any of my images I've ever seen. Like when I open that book, I go, yeah, that's what that picture's supposed to look like. That's solid. Like the blacks are really nice and everything. So do one of those, do a 36 or a 48 page book every 6 months, you know what I mean? And then stack them up on your wall like the guy in Seven, you know. Like,
hey, he had a plan. Don't rub him the wrong way.
Yeah, I don't know. It's a tricky thing because I also have a lot of prints in my closet. How often do I actually pull them out and look at them?
Well, that's not the point, though.
Right. Well, you know, yeah.
You have them.
I have them. Right, but I'm not much of a.
I mean, we talked about this when the fires were really going in California. It's still, photographs are still what people grab.
Right, which is why, just a reminder, everyone, get some offsite backup.
Yeah,
sign up for Backblaze.
I do love the idea of maybe a quarterly book or a monthly, you know, something like that. That would be kind
of
cool.
You know, interestingly enough, at the show of the what's his name? Oh my God,
Irving Penn.
No, the
Cal Penn.
Stephen Shore.
That was my third choice.
Cal Penn. Nice. At the Stephen Shore show, one of the things that he had in there were all these books that he had made on the Apple.
Oh, yeah.
The iPhoto.
Do they even do that anymore?
Good question.
Did they deprecate that?
They may have. I honestly don't know.
That was a big thing for Apple for a while.
Yeah, it was.
Deliver it in a week or something.
Yeah, and Stephen would you know, one day decide, I'm going to go do basically a photo essay today, go do this, print out 10 copies or whatever it is and give them to his friends or what have you. But they mm-hmm. were really just pictures he shot that day and did up in an iPhoto. And, you know, they had a bunch of them in the exhibit. They have them hanging from the ceiling on a cable. So you can just like, you walk through this sort of forest of books and you can just like, you know, pick one up and start looking at it. And then when you put it down, it just hangs. And they had a few made of each one. I think they must have them because they said they had a couple of each book, two or three of each book made so that as they like wore out over the exhibit, they could just put a new one up. But, but yeah, so, I mean, that's a, certainly a way to do it. Just comes down to, you know, deciding what you want to do. Probably you'd be better off. And I don't know what kinds of pictures Ryan Davies takes. Do you?
No, I don't.
Okay. Just that, you know, the ones of your family or friends are probably going to be the ones you're going to care about and look at more than anything else as you get older. So I'd say lean towards those. Josh Eikenberry.
What is this? Is this you? Yeah, this is you.
Yeah. What makes a better photographer, in-camera aptitude or a strong post-processing game?
Neither, man. It is 100% about the gear. It is all about which camera you use, which lens you use,
and
which tripod you use. That those three things: camera, lens, tripod. Yeah. Those are the three things.
Those are
the
things that are going to make your pictures good.
Yes. Next question.
Yeah, I mean, I think that this is, I don't think one makes anybody a better photographer. It's like saying, who's the better writer, the person who gets it right on the first draft or the one who refines it into, you know, something really great? It's like, they're just two different games. And I think in the modern world, I think there are very few people who really shoot something in camera and don't touch it at all on the other side, whether it's, you know, just raw conversion kind of stuff, or even just manipulating a little bit or cropping or whatever it is. Almost everybody, or everybody probably, essentially, is doing some level of post-processing.
I would have to lean toward the former, though. I would have to lean toward in-camera aptitude more than post, because I think its composition is going to make a compelling picture.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
More so, I think, than...
Yeah, but what if you're shooting elements and your composition is done in post? That's not a unfair way of looking at it.
But you're still composing. You're still composing after the fact. And I think that having a deeper knowledge of the principles of photography will serve you, because knowing the why behind it will serve you better than just knowing post-processing.
Oh, I believe. Of course. Yeah. In fact, I agree. And I think that you know, when you can, great, get it in camera. But you know, if there are limitations, you know, there are plenty of things that I could, just as an example, that I could do if I had four lights and could block off the sidewalk. I could do a better job in camera of getting this shot the way I want it, but I can't. So I do it with a speed light and I deal with it after the fact. You know what I mean? Like, there's sort of
right.
There are times when you choose to do that kind of thing too.
Is that not knowing what you're not capable of, doesn't that still qualify for in-camera aptitude? That you know what you're capable of in post.
Yeah, true. True. Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. And where on this line you sit is, you know, this swings even for me. There are times when I try to get things really right in camera, and then there are times when I, you know, either screw it up or know I want to do some crazy thing in post, you know.
Right. It's all about balance, Josh. Yep.
Nick, you want to get this one?
Nick Bedford, do you think fine art photography could be associated with a strong emphasis on pure composition, paying less attention to the subject itself? Question mark?
You answered this one on the
whether person, object, or landscape. Yeah. Nick sent this as a tweet to both of us, and I said I responded. What did I say?
C. Edward Weston.
Weston. C. Edward Weston. Right.
Who famously took pictures of peppers.
Peppers, cabbages, all sorts of things.
Pecan pie.
Yeah. I think composition, yeah. I think a great picture can be a great picture regardless of the subject matter. Sure.
Yep. Would you? Absolutely.
I mean, remember the Penn show that we saw? We took pictures of frozen food, frozen dinners, frozen vegetables and fruits.
Yeah.
And they're marvelous.
Yeah. I'm getting a weird little, like sometimes that weird
is there
like
a
USB
bug?
Audio sound.
Really?
You know that? Yeah, they're like Cylining.
Can I hear it? Can I hear it?
I think I was hearing it on your end, but as long as you think it's all right.
Hear it.
Okay. Not a big deal.
I can't hear it.
I think your answer of Edward Weston was really good. And in fact, I went and looked and said, man, have we used Edward Weston as a photographer of the week?
And have we
did in episode 3.
Yeah. Okay. What about Brett Weston?
Who's Brett Weston?
Come on, man. Brett Weston.
Brett Weston. Oh, yeah. The child genius of American photography.
Right.
Oh, we could use him.
The second of four sons of photographer Edward Weston.
Okay. Well, you know what? Let's use Brett Weston today.
Fair enough.
We'll get to that in a minute.
All right.
Foreshadowing.
Vinny.
Hey, go ahead.
No, you go ahead. It's yours.
Both of you have settled into a personal style in your work to some degree. Okay.
Thanks, Vinny.
There's a broad range between the stylistically indecisive who are trying everything without focus in the Instagram pages that are all sunset puddles in New York City at the photographer's feet with, and in a building reflected within them and everything is desaturated except orange. You get the idea of redundantly specific. Where do you personally feel your work falls in the spectrum? Do you ever get the 7-year itch and want to try something completely different?
I do want to try something different. The question is why first? I go to the why before I go to the what. Why do I want to try something different? What will that accomplish? Is it an internal exploration or is it an external exploration?
Yeah. Yeah. You think about it that much?
I don't think about it very much at all, to be honest with you. And I was talking to Sean the other day and we were talking about this very thing, ironically. Actually, we weren't talking about it ironically. It's ironic that we were talking about it. And he said, you know, if you look back at your body of work, you shoot very much the way you paint. That it's your photographs are about texture and form in the same way that your paintings are about texture and form. And I'd never put that together. And I went back and looked at it and I was like, oh, huh, I guess you're right. There is some of that. I don't think all of it is, but I definitely think there is a thread of that running through it, which kind of gets us back to some of the things that we've talked about in terms of your photographic style being much clearer in the rear view. You know, you kind of back into it, as it were.
Yeah, it always reminds me of the talk that Heisler gave at the Eddie Adams thing in October. Where he got up and he said, "Listen, no one ever."
Wait a minute. It always reminds you of something that you heard 2 months ago.
Well, because it's actually come up a number of times in the past. This is like one of those things.
I'm just busting.
No. Chops. You know how sometimes you hear somebody say something and it like, just sticks with you. You go, oh God, you know. It's like there was a, you know, I won't say it actually, spoiler. I was going to make a Star Wars, a new Star Wars comment, but I'm not going to. I'm going to keep my hand out of that boiling pot.
5 out of 10.
But he said, he said, you know, like, I never thought about my, people always say, oh, your work has this scale and this arc to it and all this kind of stuff. He says, I was never thinking about that. I was just trying to do as good of a job as I could every day that I was doing it.
Yeah.
I wasn't thinking about how it fit into some larger thing. That's going to take care of itself.
Yeah. I lit this thing this way 2 weeks ago. So now I've got to change it up a little bit.
Right. No. He's going to do the best he can that day. And if it ends up, you know, if it's a lighting setup he just found that he wants to go along with, you know, I will say from my own point of view there, I mean, there's a stuff that everyone sees that I do, but then there's lots of like weird experimental stuff I do with my dancer friends, or I do weird black and white stuff, or I did my hands a couple years ago. There's like little branches that I'll have come out of the trunk, which is the normal stuff that I'm doing. Right. Mm-hmm. And maybe some of those end up becoming a bigger thing because there's something fun and they grow. Right. Or maybe they just go out a little bit and they stop because it was a dead end, you know, or a fun thing to do that's not going to lead anywhere, or at least not going to lead anywhere for me, or didn't hold my interest, or didn't come out the way I wanted to, or kind of ran its course. That kind of stuff happens all the time. So especially when he says something like the Instagram stuff, there's lots of people say, oh, you have to have consistency because people want to just have consistency and it's got to be the same thing every time. It's like, well, that's great if what you're trying to do is create an Instagram feed, but that's not my goal, is to just create some sort of Instagram feed that's good for Instagram. You know, I want to make the work I like making. And, you know, I think it has some consistency because I make it, but I'm certainly not going to overdo that stuff. And as far as 7 year itch, you know, I think I do enough stuff playing around that I don't get bored, or at least haven't yet. It's been like 12 years, I guess. So.
I feel like I've been working on this book for 7 years.
Well, that's the thing. Jeffrey.
I've been looking for a new camera for 7 years.
I know. Yeah. It's like that.
Rob Eves, when you start noticing a theme in your work, do you actively work to develop it? I've noticed I have, quote, comfort with oneself theme, end quote, theme that came across a couple of different projects, and I'm wondering if it's something I should lean into or just let it happen. Do you guys ever notice running themes, and how do you react to seeing your own code?
That's a Matrix reference.
Yeah. Wait,
is there something different between leaning into it and just letting it happen? That's what I feel like lean into it would mean.
I think lean into it, I get that more as actively pursue that theme of
pour
comfort
gasoline
with oneself.
On that. Yeah.
Yeah. Rather than just, well, I'm going to shoot what I shoot and see if it continues to come up organically.
Okay. Yeah. All right. So where do you sit on that?
I think like anyone listening to this show at one or both at any given moment.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, it gets into why you do it. And to your point about Instagram, if you're trying to create an Instagram feed and you want that consistency and you want that sort of familiarity with your work, then you're probably going to shoot the same types of things over and over again so that people know you as the guy or girl that shoots, you know, I don't know.
Yeah.
Backlit cauliflower.
Toasters or dumpsters.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah, dumpsters. Yeah.
Or in Dan's case, Dan shoots a lot of urinals. That's what he has the thing about.
Do you just lean into it or let it happen? I don't know. I think at some point you can force your hand and go, I'm gonna actively pursue this and see what the results are. And you might notice, Rob, that leaning into it, as you say, doesn't yield the results that you're after because they weren't intentional up to this point.
Right.
It's going
a little Heisenberg's uncertainty principle. Like you start looking at it, it changes. Yeah.
It changes. Yeah. You go into it and think, okay, I'm going to pursue this, but then it ends up looking heavy handed or it ends up looking forced or worse still, it just doesn't click. It doesn't connect.
Yeah. Yeah. It's sort of if it was working without you noticing it, then stop noticing it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, don't mess with it. Go with what works. We'll do one more and then we got to do a quick sponsor and then we'll finish up here. Jason Fusera.
Hey, Jason.
I'm a bit of an omnivore when I shoot, so I find it difficult to translate my body of work into a cohesive way on my website. Most difficult is my portfolio page, which is all over the place. How do you both feel about portfolio pages in general? Do you feel that they are necessary? In cases where you don't find a portfolio, Do you think it's hard to figure out what the artist is all about? I think calling it a portfolio or not, showing your work in some organized manner is an important part of it all. I mean, it's editing, right? I mean, that's art is editing. I mean,
whether you present it as just a grid of images or as little narratives or stories or
right,
something.
Right. And if you are looking at, if you're looking at your work and you're trying to put it together, well, you know, it depends who your audience is. If you're doing it for you or for art's sake or whatever, and who cares if it's disjointed and all over the place? Like maybe that's your art, is that you're, you know, seeing everything in all kinds of ways. If you're trying to sell yourself as a wedding photographer and you're putting up pictures of bridges with ducks on them, well, you know what I mean? Like there's, right. You know your audience, I guess.
What I will say about your work, Jason, I'm on your site right now, Shadow Quality. Shadowquality.com. You've got a menu item for portfolio, which is great. But then you've also got a menu item for recent work and one, two, three other things. Aren't those things all yeah. part of your portfolio? I mean, everything on this website is technically part of your portfolio.
Yes.
So I think there's a little bit of confusion just from a navigational standpoint on your site of how is portfolio different to me, the end user visiting your site, than the other sections that are listed in the main nav.
Yeah. And if you're looking at that first page, right, the only one that stands out is like one of these things is not like the other is that guitar double exposure with the records and the guitar outline
yep.
on the left.
Yep.
And it's a neat picture. It's a good idea, but it's the only one that sticks out to me as like, oh, this one doesn't go with the rest. If you take that out, it's like, okay,
yeah, they're all
so
pretty
he's a
cohesive.
Landscape, cityscape, you know, nature photographer guy. You know what I mean? Like that doesn't make me feel like you're all over the place. And this is way less all over the place than a lot of people are, I guess is the better way to put it.
Mm-hmm.
And his work's good. So like, I think ultimately for me, I think if quality wins out, if your work is good, then, you know, how it's presented and all this kind of stuff, I don't know that it matters as quite as much. I think people yeah. are looking at the work.
If I were you, I would lose portfolio and aggregate that work into its appropriate,
just let people other, go to landscapes or.
Yeah. I mean, have recent, maybe, you know, have recent work sorted by date or yep. whatever, but let all that stuff in portfolio live where you think it would naturally live based on the subnav.
Yeah.
Locations. That would be what I would do. Anyway.
Yep. 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 I agree.
Good work though, Jason. Really nice
yeah.
stuff.
Delightfully nice work. I should just put a link right there. We're gonna send
yeah,
some
not?
People to Fusera.
Send Jason some love.
Boom, in the show notes. We should talk about our friends at FreshBooks real quick before we finish this thing up. If you're a freelancer out there, Jeffrey, and you need to make enough money to pay your taxes for the fourth quarter. You need some cloud accounting software from FreshBooks. Taxes. You pay taxes? Wait, you make income? You know,
after the other day, we're going to pay more.
Oh, yeah, exactly. You can spend less time working on your business paperwork and more time making your art by using FreshBooks, the ridiculously easy cloud accounting software. For the people are from Toronto.
Yeah.
They're Canadians. Of course they're nice people and they make good products. By simplifying tasks like invoicing, tracking expenses, and getting paid online, FreshBooks has drastically reduced the time it takes for over 10 million people to deal with their paperwork, Jeffrey. And they can save a couple hours a month, a couple hours a week. Depends on how much time you spend on your paperwork. I'm more of a couple hours a month kind of guy, but you know. Some people spend a lot of time doing this kind of stuff. You can send clean, professional-looking invoices in about 30 seconds with FreshBooks. With literally two clicks, you can set yourself up to receive payments online. You can deal with all your mobile expenses. You can take pictures of your receipts on your phone using the FreshBooks app and make claiming your expenses a million times easier by just attaching that lunch straight to the invoice so your client will pay for it. Rebuilt from the ground up, FreshBooks has been completely redesigned from the ground up and custom built for the way that you work. Get ready for the simplest way to be more productive, organized, and most important, get paid quickly. And you'll get paid quickly by using their notifications feature. It acts like your personal assistant. You'll always know what's changed in your business since you last log on, who paid, who hasn't paid, overdue invoices that are going to get automated late payment reminders so that people are reminded that they still owe you $55.26 for that lunch that you had. So go check it out. They got
$55 at lunch. What did you eat?
I know. Multi-currency invoicing. Also, if you're working around the world, you can get your stuff in euros or yen or wait, what are the Chinese yuan? Is that what it is? Chinese yuan? I think it's something like that.
Wonton, I think is what you're talking
about. Yeah, no. That's
is that something else?
That's just offensive, yeah.
How is that offensive? I love wonton.
And if you have any problems, you can...
wonton soup. Now I want some wonton soup.
I know, it's good stuff. You can contact FreshBooks award-winning customer service. They're amazingly helpful, super friendly people with zero attitude, plus a real-life person usually answers in three rings or less. Go check them out. If you've listened to this and you're not using FreshBooks yet, now would be the time to try. FreshBooks is offering an unrestricted 30-day free trial for all of our listeners. No credit cards required. All you have to do is go to FreshBooks.com and enter on taking pictures in the How Did You Hear From Us section. Also, you know, be aware that this is the end of the year. The new year is starting. It's a perfect time to switch to a new invoicing system. So all of your stuff from next year is all in one place. So go check out FreshBooks. We thank them very much for the support of the show. All right,
let's really do want wonton soup now. There's a Chinese restaurant that we have not tried yet that some friends recommended. Maybe I'll go there tonight.
Well, you can go get some on the way on your errands after the show.
Yeah.
You got Frank?
Are you a Chinese food fan?
I like Chinese food, and we have a fairly good Chinese restaurant around here. In fact, Conrad and I got Chinese food the first night I took her picture that I like sort of reconnected with her from that place, which is 10 years ago next Wednesday. So,
I love Chinese food.
Yeah. I'm a General Tso's chicken guy. I do like noodles, and they have these really amazing, good, fresh, like the noodles on the table, like the, you know, crispy noodles. They make them fresh at our place with fresh duck sauce. Oh, it's addictive. Anyway, Frank, you got this one?
Yeah. Frank, I feel like I should just forward you the ridiculous questions that I get asked during the holidays, like, number one, when I take my iPhone to the pharmacy to get pictures developed, can they do 1 hour photo?
Yeah. Now, to be fair, just because
I don't
understand
that question.
I think the idea is that you used to have to drop it off and they would process the film and then make you print and you pick them up in an hour.
Right.
I think Frank's making the comment that nowadays they could just do the print and it'll take 30 seconds, theoretically, you know, to print them out. I will say that it's not always that fast because sometimes they're working on other stuff and you're in a queue. So it might actually still take an hour. But yes.
Number two, I sent my photos to the Flickr app on my phone. How do I get them back to put them online?
The answer to that is, why are you using Flickr?
Right. Search AltaVista for how that can pay off for you.
Exactly.
My personal favorite, I want a good camera to take pictures like you, but I don't want to spend a lot of money or learn photography. I just want to, quote, take pictures with it. What's a good cheap camera that can do that?
That is pretty good, though. Like, that is actually the kind of question. I mean, even with my setup, people are like, oh, my God, that camera you have takes such wonderful pictures. It's like,
It does, doesn't it? No, it does. It does.
It does. It's fantastic. Yeah.
Yeah. For about 6,000 more actuations.
Oh, it'll be fine.
I'm just going to get under your skin. I'm going to get in your head, man.
I don't, you know, there's nothing I could do about it. I'll just wait till it dies and then I'll, you know, fix it.
All right. Nothing some duct tape couldn't fix.
Yeah, exactly.
Those are pretty funny questions. Why? Yeah.
Probably true, too.
Yeah. What would you recommend? Let's take that last part seriously. What is a good, inexpensive camera that you would recommend?
One on your phone that you have in your pocket. Honestly, if you go above that, RX100, you know what I mean? Like you got to spend a few hundred dollars to get something that's worth going to.
Right.
And that's
Does Canon still make the T-Series?
The
SLR series, like the T5i, T6i, do they still make those?
Oh, yeah, like the old digital Rebels.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, sure. Yeah.
Those are good cameras.
Yeah.
And they're inexpensive.
It's probably $399 with a kit lens, you know?
Yeah.
But honestly, I mean, you might be better off with just some little tiny camera, you know, like again, that Sony one, it's like 1-inch sensor. My friend Randy, he loves those things.
Is that the RX100?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Randy uses one of those. Coupon uses one of those. Like that's what they carry. Apparently that's what all my old photographer friends carry around.
What do we got here? RX 105, the premium.
That's the, yeah, the new one. It was compact. $700?
$949.
Sometimes you can get like the version 3, which is basically the same sensor with very little less for a lot less. At least you could last time I looked years ago. I don't know. I mean, honestly, the phone, your phones nowadays with the computational photography and the special chips they have in them and everything. If you have a recent Samsung, Apple, or Google phone, the camera, it's going to be pretty darn good, and you're not going to get that much better unless you want to get involved and learn how to do stuff in photography, you know?
Right, right. I think there are some terrific entry-level cameras now, too.
Yeah. But, I mean, I don't know that sort of out-of-camera JPEGs are going to be that much better unless you're in weird situations where you're trying to shoot your kid playing soccer or, you know what I mean, like situations where you need longer lenses or low light or whatever it is. But your average just, hey, my friends and I are going on vacation, like, you know, get one of these new phones with the normal lens in them too, and you'll be fine.
Or you can pick up a D750.
How much is that?
Nikon D750, which on a lot of people's list, this was their pick for.
Wait, is the 750 the 12 megapixel one still?
No, it's 24. That's the D500. And that's crop. This is D750 full frame, 24 megapixel, 3.2 inch tilty flippy screen.
Right. How much?
B&H has it with the battery grip and the 24-120 lens for $19.95.
There you go.
$1,400 holiday savings.
$1,400 holiday savings.
Right. Also includes an extra battery, a 64 gig memory card.
They're going to give you all those little tricky things.
And a shoulder bag.
You're a professional photographer for just right. $2,000.
Get yourself a Canon has a rebate on the Pixma 100, so you can print yourself up a press pass, and you've got the camera.
Wait, how much is the Pixma 100 going for now? That's the one you have?
I think Wilkening just bought another one. I think he said it was a 130, 140.
Do you or anybody else who has one of those printed stuff out, had it where sun could get to it, and it's actually held up to the sun?
Yes, I got mine 107 years ago, and it's been in direct sun.
Well, no.
It looks
like that's my thing is that like it's dye inks, right?
Yeah,
right. And so I've had dye printers in the past, and in 5 years, that's not the same print.
Dye inks have come a long way. They are light fast. Canon is claiming that they're light fast, well over 100 years.
Okay.
Are they as good as pigment? I don't know.
Yeah, they technically have a larger gamut, I think.
Yeah, $149 for the Pixma 100. It's $399 with a $250 rebate. I did this when I bought mine. I got the rebate, no problem. In fact, it was pretty speedy in getting the rebate.
That is crazy cheap.
Yeah. I mean, it's going to cost you that to buy more ink for it.
Right. So no. That's nuts. Yeah. To get $50 off, where did you find it with the rebate?
B&H.
Oh, interesting. Yeah. They don't have
Pixma
it listed.
Pixma Pro 100 here.
Pixma Pro 100. There we go. Boom.
You got it?
I'm going to the site. Okay. Oh yeah, pay $399, $250 mail-in rebate. Look at that.
Yeah. And it's a good printer. I really like it. I think it does a terrific job. It's 13x19.
Yep.
For $150. Yes, it uses dye-based ink, but I have had no problem with it. I've printed on matte glossy luster. I've done emulsion transfers with it. I have no complaints, and I actually really like their software. The
looks pretty small too.
Yeah, it's
as smaller than most of these kind of printers are.
Yeah, it's not bad. It's maybe 20 or so inches wide. I think I'm looking
cheap
at it right now. Yeah, it's not bad.
We're getting close to your drop-off time. So let's do this last one real quick, and then we'll get to the group. Yep. Tim Sharp, what percentage of recognized photographers, photographers of the week on shows like OTP, are able to make middle-income living on photography? And out of those who do, what is the most common field of photography? Portrait, architectural, editorial, commercial advertising?
I would have no way to know that.
I don't have any, I have anecdotal evidence of all of this. I think, there are editorial photographers who make a good living, although that's harder and harder as magazines kind of disappear. Commercial advertising photographers probably, if you are successful at it and get work, make the most money. out of all of those that you're talking about. And if you do get that kind of work, you can make a lot of money. Although, you know, that's a really hard,
I would say that's a small number.
It's a very small number, but that's sort of like at one end of the spectrum. I think that there are a lot of people who are portrait photographers who are shooting people, like, you know, shooting families and or mm-hmm. shooting events or doing engagement photos and that kind of stuff. I think that there's a solid living in that if you do it right.
Yeah. There's some crossover too. I mean, look, yeah. Dan, we talk about Dan Winters a lot. He is a portrait photographer, but he also shoots editorial. He shoots, you know, fine art. He shoots,
yep. Yep.
You know, all kinds of things.
And Mr. Wong down in Austin, right? He shoots architectural stuff. Patrick Wong, friend of the show. And he seems to make a good living. I don't know how much money, you know, I don't know how he does. I'm not signing on to that, but he does a lot of work. So, you know what I mean? There's work in architectural stuff too, if that's a, you
mm-hmm,
know,
mm-hmm.
Just don't go do it in Austin and take our friend's work away from him.
yeah. Move somewhere else.
So I think it can be done. I think that there are also a lot of photographers of the week and photographers we talk about who are doing it for art's sake or have family money or are married to somebody who can help support them or I think that is, or are doing it on the side or mm-hmm. don't require
do
a lot
also
of money
because they workshops live in a cheap place. Or, yeah.
Right. Or they do workshops or they teach. Like, I think that there's all of those things too. So, you know, blending that in, I think that all of these, you could make a middle income living from all these things. It just comes down to what your desires are. You know, like, I don't live in a giant apartment. Other than a very modest size apartment, but I don't really want any more room and I don't care. And that's not my goal, you know, is to have a giant place. So, it's interesting. I don't know what
I would say it's not a huge number.
That make a middle income living.
Yeah. And yeah. I would say that there are probably secondary sources that contribute to that, as you pointed out.
Yeah. I think that's a part of a lot of people's situation. Mm-hmm. But you know, there are certainly people who make a living doing photography.
Sure. You know,
like, that's true. So, since these people haven't gone to the group, I can't really go to the group because only people have only had 2 days to put up pictures.
Yeah. You want to bag the assignment? Let's bag the assignment for this one.
Okay. We'll give people a week off.
Yeah. No assignment. Go enjoy yourselves. Go enjoy your families. Or if you're listening to this after Christmas, hope you enjoyed yourselves and your families.
Hope it wasn't too painful. All right, let's talk about Brett Weston then, since he came up.
Brett Weston.
Ooh,
bum, bum, bum. Yeah, so originally Theodore Brett Weston, so says Wiki, was an American photographer. Van Deren Koch described Brett Weston as, quote, the child genius of American photography. He was the second of four sons of photographer Edward Weston and Flora Chandler. Began making photographs in 1925. That's where I know him from.
You went to high school with him.
Quiet kid, sat in the back. Damn it.
That's genius.
Yeah.
It's good stuff.
Inherited his father's love of kind of abstracting everyday objects.
Yeah, I think those are some of the strongest stuff is sort of the abstract ice and water and reflections. Like, he does a lot of that kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Or, you know, like, there's pictures of a tide pool where it's like reflections in certain water and also, you know, rocks coming out and stuff that, certain flowers or trees. I think some of that stuff is really, really strong.
You know, the shot of Monument Valley. Look at this. I just pasted this into Skype.
Okay. I'll take a look. If I could figure out how to get to the Skype conversation.
I know. Stupid Skype.
Oh yeah, look at that. See?
Beautiful.
Yep. That's where it's at. You can't go wrong with Monument Valley. I've driven down that road. It was very scary in the car we were in.
I like these underwater nudes too, with the refraction kind of, you know, rippling over the form. That's really neat.
Yeah, where'd you find those?
It's on the Brett Weston archive. Here you go. There you go.
Thank you, sir.
It's just the reflections and the surface patterns give these interesting textures.
Oh, see,
to
that
the
is neat. The way the light.
Isn't that cool?
Yeah. These are 1970s, so he was in his 50s. Ooh, look at those.
Aren't they beautiful? I love them.
Some really nice stuff in here.
Mm-hmm.
Good one. I haven't really explored his stuff much.
Yeah.
Brett Weston died in, what was it, 93. January 22nd, 93.
The camera for an artist is just another tool. It is no more mechanical than a violin if you analyze it. Beyond the rudiments, it is up to the artist to create art, not the camera. Brett Weston.
I think that wraps it up.
Yeah.
That wraps up this year on taking pictures right there. That's a good quote.
Wait, is this the last one of the year?
Yeah, right.
No, is it?
I'm saying we're start. No, it's not the last one of the year six, but it's the last one of 2017. Because next week is the 26th. The next week after that would be January. 7th.
That's right. Yeah. Holy moly.
Yep. Another one in that. The can.
Did.
What? Not in the can. Oh, Jeffrey. Just because you spend that much time in the can.
What?
At your age.
Where else am I going to read?
If you want to get a hold of us, 347-687-9411. You can email us, podcast@ontakingpictures.com, at Bill Wadman, at Jeffrey Sidoris, photographybytheletter.com next week, next 2 weeks. When are you going to put that up?
They may actually, well, they should be up by the time you are listening to this show. If not, they will be up by the 30th and start shipping by the 30th, because that's when we'll be back from our vacation.
So go buy Jeffrey's book. And
go buy my book. Please, please, please buy my book.
Take my wife. No, seriously.
If you buy my book, I will send you a copy of my book.
Are you going to sign?
That's how serious I am.
Are you going to sign the book?
I will sign them.
You're going to sign each one as you send it out?
I would love to. If you want it signed, fine. If you don't want it signed, you'll get it signed.
Can you put a checkbox on the... yeah, that's nice. You can have it any color you want, as long as it's black.
That's right. Yeah, if you buy a copy, I will send you a copy. That's how it's going to work. Yeah.
You're like some sort of it's a retail wizard. Genius.
I am. You know what? You know what you can even do? You can buy two.
God.
Yeah. You can buy two.
One with each eye. It's a stereo photography
or
thing.
Give one to your friends.
Yeah.
Or give one to somebody who's not really your friend. And when they see it, they'll be your friend.
Oh, see, I thought you were going somewhere else with that. But okay,
no.
Sure.
No. It's a friend maker.
Jeffrey's book, The Friend Maker.
The Friend Maker. That's right.
All right. Go enjoy your holiday, and we'll see you all in 2018. Yes.
See you all in 2018. So what is the date of the next one, the next show?
Well, the first, I think, is the, I don't know, I'll tell you exactly. Hold on.
Wait, what's today?
It will 26. Be the...
It'll be the second.
It'll be the second, although, I guess it'll be the second.
January 2nd. All right. If we don't see you somewhere, if we don't talk to you somewhere, have a fantastic New Year's Eve.
It's true.
Yep. You doing anything for New Year's Eve? We're going to a party.
I have no idea yet. It's way down in the distance.
We have already RSVP'd to a very nice party.
10 days out. Too far away.
Have a great time. Be safe. Kiss the ones you love.
Hmm. Make sure they give you permission first.
Yeah, no kidding, right? Yeah, don't be one of those guys. Don't go all Weinstein on somebody.
Oh, all right. Enough said.
Is it a verb? Too soon? Can we do that?
Too soon.
All right, thanks for listening, everyone. We will see you next time.
Going on and on the way we are for so long. Too many fools, it's plain to see something. This way, say what you want to say, though I know your words will lay me out, so I can hear you think out loud. Going through your thoughts the way I have for too long, it's clear to me the this way.